You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
Okay, good morning. My name is Justin. I'm one of the elders here. We're going to be teaching this morning together, but I want to start our morning off with a little bit of a game. This game is going to be Name That Famous Couple. I'm going to give you a riddle, okay? What I want you to do is I want you to guess that famous couple, but don't yell it out right away. I'll kind of point to you at the end. We want everybody to think about this and be able to play along. Got it? Pretty simple, right? Riddle number one. Here we go. Famous couple number one. He loved dinosaurs and monkeys, but her even more. After all, he's her lobster. Oh, folks. There you go. And Ross and who? Ross and Rachel. Yes, very good. There they are. No, that's the wrong way, folks. Come on. There we go. Okay, good job. Riddle number two. Mammals and amphibians don't often pair up, but I guess pink and green do look good together. Folks, who is it? Kermit and Miss Piggy, very good. Number three, this one might be hard. He's her Indian outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. She's his wild one running free. There we go, Tim McGraw and Faith Hill. Here's a fun one. Neither giant rats, nor fire swamps, nor pirates can keep true love apart. As you wish. And Buttercup, that's correct. There they are. Okay, folks, number five, the perfect date. Well, ask if she wants to eat food, get her the world's best coffee, and then sing loud for all to hear. Elf, and what was her name? Jovi, that is correct. There they are. Last one. She spends her time in front of the lights. He spends his under them. They both like the color red. Who? No? Which of the Hail Girls? Come on, Hail Girls. Speak up. They both like the color red. Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. How could you not get that? Okay, listen. Now, you're probably familiar with most of those couples that we just mentioned. I mean, they're all pretty famous. But this morning, we're actually going to talk about a couple who you might not be very familiar with. In fact, maybe you've never even heard of them. This couple, their names are Priscilla and Aquila. And we find their story in the New Testament. And even though there aren't a whole lot of verses written about them, I think you'll agree that by the end of this morning that they really deserve a place in our Heroes series. Now, Priscilla and Aquila first appear in Acts 18. The writer of Acts, and his name was Luke, and this is what he says. Then Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he became acquainted with a Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently arrived from Italy with his wife Priscilla. They had left Italy when Claudius Caesar deported all Jews from Rome. Paul lived and worked with them, for they were tent makers just as he was. So we have Paul. This is the same Paul that Chris talked about 2 weeks ago. The Paul who had a crazy encounter with God. He went from persecuting Christ followers to preaching about Jesus. He's on his second missionary journey when we read this story. He is traveling around to different cities throughout the Roman Empire, spreading the gospel. And he's just arrived in Corinth. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to have some maps up here today, just so you can kind of get a lay of the land, if you will. And I'm going to circle the important cities as we're talking about them. So once he got there, Paul met a man named Aquila. We don't know a lot about Aquila's past. We know that he was originally from Pontus in the modern-day Turkey. We know that he was living in Rome. We know that he was Jewish and that he had a wife named Priscilla. Now, according to the passage, all Jews, including Priscilla and Aquila, had been deported from Rome by Claudius Caesar. Caesar wasn't his last name. It just meant emperor. And we know that history tells us this happened around the year 52 AD. So we're roughly 20 years after Jesus' crucifixion. And the church is still young. And what's happening is that these Jewish people that didn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah, they were persecuting the Jewish people that did believe Jesus was the Messiah. And Emperor Claudius got tired of all the bickering and all the uproar that this was causing in his city, so he decided to kick all the Jews out. It didn't matter whether they were part of the disturbances or not. It didn't matter whether they believed that Jesus was the Messiah or not. All of them were uprooted from their homes, everything that was familiar to them, and they were banished. So, Priscilla and Aquila left Rome, and they headed off to Corinth. Folks, this wasn't just around the block. We're talking 600 miles away as the crow flies. It says they were tent makers. At that time, tents were woven out of goat hair, out of camel hair. And this was a really good craft to have. Tents were in high demand. Merchants would have used them. Travelers would have used them. The military would have used them. So Corinth also would have been a really good place to set up shop. This was the commercial center of Greece at the time. Lots of people buying and selling. Lots of people coming and going. Tent selling was a good business. Now, one thing to note, all Jewish boys were taught a trade when they were young, probably passed down from their fathers, like through an apprenticeship. It's how they would make their living then as they grew up. So Aquila was taught how to make tents, probably by his dad, and he in turn taught his wife Priscilla, because it says they worked together. Not all couples can do that, but they seem to pull it off just fine. And we also see that Paul shared in that same skill set. So as Paul was traveling around on his journeys, he would serve as a tent maker to help support himself. So Paul connected with Priscilla and Aquila because they shared in the same trade. And not only did he work with them, we read that he lived with them. So not too much of a stretch to think that the three of them bonded pretty quickly. Later in the same chapter of Acts, here's what we read. Paul stayed in Corinth for some time after that, then said goodbye to the brothers and sisters. Then he set sail for Syria, taking Priscilla and Aquila with him. They stopped first at the port of Ephesus, where Paul left the others behind. We know Paul stayed in Corinth for about 18 months before he continued on with his journey. And we know that now he had some traveling companions. He had Priscilla and Aquila. We don't know exactly when this couple became Christ followers. It might have been back in Rome before the exile. Maybe it was when they were working and living with Paul. But we definitely know that by the time they set sail here, it seems that they're committed followers of Jesus. Now, while Paul traveled on, Priscilla and Aquila stayed back in Ephesus, and they began to minister to the city. Sometime later, Paul returns. He comes back to Ephesus. He reunites with our couple, and from there, he's writing a letter to the church back in Corinth. And this is what he says. The churches here in the province of Asia, that would have included Ephesus, send greetings in the Lord, as do Aquila and Priscilla and all the others who gather in their home for church meetings. So Priscilla and Aquila had opened their home to Paul back when they were in Corinth, and now they were opening their home to a church in Ephesus. Still in Ephesus, their story continues. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, an eloquent speaker who knew the scriptures well, had arrived in Ephesus from Alexandria in Egypt. He had been taught the way of the Lord. He taught others about Jesus with an enthusiastic spirit and accuracy. However, he knew only about John's baptism. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him preaching boldly in the synagogue, they took him aside and explained the way of God even more accurately. You see, Apollos was a gifted preacher. He knew the Old Testament scriptures. He would have known the prophecies about the coming Messiah. And he knew about Jesus. But we read that something was missing from the story. We don't know exactly what that something was. It's thought that maybe he didn't know about the giving of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. Maybe he didn't know about the Great Commission to go out and make disciples of all nations, including sending the message to non-Jews. Apollos had the potential to be used mightily in the kingdom if he only knew the rest of the story. If you know Paul Harvey, there you go. So enter Priscilla and Aquila. They heard Apollos speak. They realized that they could share with him the rest of the story. They didn't just turn their backs on him. They didn't choose not to help him. As a couple, they took him aside. They invested in him. They taught him the truth about Jesus. They discipled him. And in turn, He became an effective servant of God who some of the Corinthians later put on the same spiritual level as Paul and Peter. That's a pretty big level. Sometime later again, we learn that Priscilla and Aquila have moved back to Rome. Emperor Claudius had died, and therefore the exile of all the Jews had ended. They could return home. And that's exactly what our couple did. They returned back to Rome. And Paul is now writing from Corinth. Remember, he's traveling all around, so he's writing from different locations. He's writing from Corinth to the church in Rome, and in Romans 16, this is what he says. Give my greetings to Priscilla and Aquila, my co-workers in the ministry of Christ Jesus. In fact, they once risked their lives for me. I am thankful to them, and so are all the Gentile churches. Also give my greetings to the church that meets in their home. Paul's wording here reflects just how much Priscilla and Aquila mean to him, because the Greek word for give my greetings is actually give them a big bear hug from me. And the word he uses for co-workers is the Greek synergia. That's where we get our word synergy. It's this idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That just means that they were able to achieve more as a couple than they ever could do individually. We also learn from this passage that somehow they saved Paul's life, and we don't know the details of that, but they risked their necks for him. Whatever it was a really big deal, because not only does Paul thank them, but he says that all the Gentile churches thank them as well. Fast forward again. Priscilla and Aquila are now back in Ephesus. If you're kind of tracking along, what we have here is they started off in Rome. They were exiled and went to Corinth. They traveled to Ephesus with Paul. They went back home after the exile. We are now back in Ephesus. Why? Well, let me tell you. Priscilla and Aquila had been living back in Rome for about 10 years when catastrophe struck the city. The great fire of July 19th, 64. This fire destroyed or seriously damaged almost the entire city. At the time, the rumor was that the emperor Nero had started the fire because he wanted to clear land, because he wanted to build himself a bigger palace. Historians looking back think it was probably just more of a tragic accident. But whatever the case was, back in the day, Nero decided to put the blame of the fire squarely on the early Christian community. They became the scapegoats for Rome's destruction. And this began a time of severe persecution for Christians throughout the empire. So Priscilla and Aquila, maybe they were homeless at this point. Maybe they were just afraid of the persecution. They went back to Ephesus. And Paul, once again, is writing, but he's in prison this time. He's actually been sentenced to death by Nero. He's writing the last words in the last letter that he would ever write. This is it for him. And here's what Paul says to the young pastor Timothy in 2 Timothy. He's writing to Timothy, but he says this: give my greetings to Priscilla and Aquila. The end of his life is near. Paul takes the time to give a shout out to his friends, his partners in ministry for the past 16 years. It was his goodbye. That's the story of Priscilla and Aquila. Mentioned only 6 times in the entire Bible, encompassing only a handful of verses. We actually read through all of them. And yet this couple had such an impact on Paul and on Apollos, who had an impact then in turn on others, that the church may not have turned out quite the way it did without them. One more note before we move on, because this is very interesting. In 4 of the 6 times that they are mentioned, Priscilla's name comes first. And this was really unusual when names are mentioned in the Bible. It's almost always the husband being mentioned first. And scholars think that this suggests that Priscilla had a leading role in their ministry as a couple. It wasn't all about her husband Aquila and she was just tagging along. Each of them had a vital role to play in the story. Now this morning, we're going to talk about togetherness. Note the play on words there. And what does togetherness look like according to the example set by Priscilla and Aquila? And you don't have to be married to apply all these things to your life, but I'm going to tell you that marriage is going to be where our application is directed for you marrieds, for you folks that want to be married. And I'm going to give you a heads up. This is a very application-heavy talk this morning. And we're going to look at their togetherness alongside a passage from Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is part of the wisdom literature found in the Old Testament, probably written by King Solomon. Most of the book actually teaches about the meaningless of riches, the meaningless of power, the meaningless of wisdom, because all things are meaningless when compared to a relationship with God. But then we come to this passage found in chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. It says this: two people are better than one. They can help each other in everything they do. Suppose either of them falls down, then the one can help the other one up. But suppose a person falls down and doesn't have anyone to help them up, then feel sorry for that person. Or suppose two people lie down together, then they'll keep warm. But how can one person keep warm alone? One person could be overpowered, but two people can stand up for themselves. And a rope made of three cords isn't easily broken. At this time, I'm going to ask my wife, Steph, to join me on stage. You know, over the years, we have taught several times about the topic of marriage. We don't do it because we have the whole marriage thing figured out. Our marriage is not perfect, but we do it because we really care about marriage. We care about our marriage. We care about your marriage. And that brings us to this: Priscilla and Aquila, making an impact by a life of partnership. Let's just look at what togetherness is and togetherness isn't. Togetherness is being together. Surprise, surprise, right? As we read the story of Priscilla and Aquila, the first thing that stands out is that one is never mentioned without the other. All six times, the story is about Priscilla and Aquila. It's not Priscilla's story. It's not Aquila's story. It's a story of them together, as a couple, as partners, as husband and wife, as a team. And if we look at the first verse in our Ecclesiastes passage, we see the value in this. Two people are better than one. In Hebrew, the word for better implies harmony. It implies wholeness. So it's not just that a relationship with someone else is more than good. It's that a relationship with someone else brings harmony. It brings wholeness. Life can be more. You know, when I got married, it was no longer about me doing my own thing. It was no longer just my story. And when Steph got married, it was no longer about Steph doing her own thing. It was no longer Steph's story. Now it's Justin and Steph's story. And we're joined together. That's what the pastor says during the wedding ceremony, right? What God has joined together.
And togetherness is more than just living under the same roof, because a lot of couples have that proximity thing down. But togetherness is actually liking your spouse. And more than that, it is being best friends with your spouse. So your spouse is the only person who can be your best friend. So not a best friend growing up from childhood, or your brother or sister, or your kid. That spot in your life belongs to your spouse.
The best marriages, the ones that experience true togetherness, are built on friendship. Many of you know my story. In college, I became very close friends my senior year with a spunky 5-foot brunette from Jersey, who told me right after I graduated, literally, folks, the night that I graduated from college, she told me we would only ever be friends.
I was right.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Fortunately, less than a year later, she came around, realized that she couldn't live without me, and that she wanted to be best friends together for the rest of our lives. That's right. Very good. Here we are, 26 years later. We are still best friends. And we really enjoy being around each other. We really like each other. I have a number of other friends, but she's my bestie. Maybe we need to get bracelets. Probably. Yeah, maybe bracelets.
Those necklaces.
Yeah. It's because we're best friends, though, that we can work so well as a team.
So for you singles, take lots and lots of time to develop a friendship before you take your relationship to the next level. Because if you don't have a good friendship, it's not going to make for a good marriage. Trust me, you're going to need that basis of a friendship once you get into the marriage thing. So if you can't see yourself being best friends with the person that you're dating right now for the rest of your life, you might want to reconsider whether you take that to the next level. If you guys want practical ways to build up or rekindle the friendship in your marriage, we actually taught Enjoy Your Spouse last summer.
The second part of our Ecclesiastes 4:9 says, they can help each other in everything they do. Now think about this. If we as individuals had it all together, you know, if we were perfect in every way, would we need help? Well, of course not. But that's not reality. You know, we all have our weaknesses. We all have our shortcomings. areas in which we don't excel, personality traits that are lacking. It's just part of being human. But here's where a spouse can step in. Two individuals working together can complement one another. If one spouse is weak in something, maybe it's the other one's gift. For instance, Steph, for the most part, is better at generating ideas. I, for the most part, am better at planning and putting those ideas into motion. I can reach things above our fridge in the cabinets. Steph can crawl under our bed to get the winter clothes bins. Now, in nature, this idea of complementary gifts and abilities is illustrated by the teamwork of ostriches and zebras. You probably didn't know this. And they hang out together. Ostriches have a superior sense of smell, but they have terrible eyesight. Zebras have terrific eyesight, but a poor sense of smell. But by working together, they can be more alert for predators, and they increase their chances of not being eaten.
Zebras and ostriches would have been way cooler than pictures of celebrities.
Yeah, well, it was not in the budget this year. Maybe next time. God designed marriage as the ultimate harmony, the ultimate partnership, bringing two people together with different personalities, different gifts, different strengths, different backgrounds, bringing them together as one. And just like God uses our unique gifts and abilities to strengthen his church, so we can also use our unique gifts and abilities to create a powerful marriage where we truly can help each other in everything we do. And when we succeed together, we really get to celebrate together. So togetherness is being together, but togetherness isn't just sex. One of the most used scriptures when we talk marriage is found in Matthew 19. And Jesus is quoting Genesis here. And he says this. This explains why a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. Since they are no longer two but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. And when we hear this, especially I think when guys hear this, we often think it's talking about sex, joined together, two into one. And that's certainly a part of it, but it's only a part of it. Most of married life happens outside the bedroom. And the things that happen in the bedroom don't start in the bedroom. We need other areas of connection along with the physical to experience the togetherness that God intended.
Connection happens between us as we continually get to know each other. And another word for that is intimacy. But again, intimacy does not mean just sex. There was some research that was done by a couple, Howard and Charlotte Kleinbell, and they suggest there are actually 9 areas of intimacy. And true togetherness can actually happen if we experience each of these areas within our marriage. So we're going to take a look at all 9 real quick and spell it out for you and maybe give you guys another idea of what intimacy looks like.
So first off, we have emotional intimacy, and this is the sharing of our feelings. You know, this is the thing that guys just love to do. I mean, I love to do this. I do, yeah. But emotional intimacy is all about being vulnerable with our spouse. What are you worried about? What makes you happy? Why are you sad? Why did you get angry about that? Opening up in this way to someone isn't comfortable. It's really hard to admit that we're worried or that we're frustrated. And it's really hard to admit our weaknesses and our fears. But your spouse is your teammate. They're there to support you. And you probably know this already, but women generally feel the most connected to their husbands when emotional intimacy is highest.
So the second one is intellectual intimacy, and it's sharing in the world of ideas. This kind of intimacy is actually higher early on in your relationship because you want to know more and more and more about your spouse. You ask lots of questions. What do you like? How'd you grow up? What's your family like? What are your hobbies? And all that stuff is just the sharing of ideas. Now, the longer we're in relationship, the less we ask those kind of questions because we assume we know. But we need to keep asking questions or even just talk about stuff. Like, this might sound boring, but Justin and I will talk about medical research that just came out or whatever. We're nerds. But you can talk about other fun news or current events like, you know, the awesome data center that nobody wants here because I don't want a data center. But it's just talking about anything. You can watch a movie and then sit back and evaluate the foreshadowing. Something intellectual, just get it done. Anything that stimulates your brain cells together.
How about aesthetic intimacy? This is not one that I had ever thought of. This is sharing in experiences of beauty. Maybe this includes appreciating works of art or a piece of music together. Maybe it's just standing out there looking up at the night sky at God's creation. Maybe you're up on a hiking trail on the side of a mountain and you're looking across the valley. Steph and I, when we go away to the Outer Banks, we enjoy watching the sunrise over the ocean and the sunset over the Sound. It's really anything that the two of you can experience together and look at and say, wow, that's beautiful, or that's amazing.
So the next one is creative intimacy. Obviously, this is sharing in the acts of creativity. So whereas aesthetic was things you view, creative is things that you do or get done together and create together, and kids don't count. But maybe like a new recipe, you come up with a new recipe and then you cook it together. Or you can pick a new color to paint your living room and get it done. Maybe it's like redoing your landscaping. Hey, what plants do we want to put in here? Just things that you get to be creative together. And not all of us are super duper creative, but everybody has a little bit of creativity in them. You could get the crayons out, sit down and make cards for each other some night. For us, we have this long-term planned project of decorating our bedroom in a beach theme. So every year we go to the Outer Banks, we try to grab a piece of beach art to decorate our bedroom.
Okay, how about recreation intimacy? This is sharing activities, having fun times. When we're dating or newly married, we're all about having fun together. But as time goes on and life gets busier and things get in the way, making fun oftentimes takes a back seat to everything else. But it needs to be a priority. And as we shared last year, if you're having trouble figuring out what this looks like as a couple, think back to when you were dating. Think back when you were early married. How did you have fun together? How did you laugh together? Do those things. Anything from crosswords to board games to card games. Work out together. Go for a hike. Go on dates. Hey, you're married at this point. Go away together. That's probably some of the most fun we have throughout the year.
Yeah. And then we have work intimacy. And this is the sharing in common tasks. This isn't necessarily working for your optometrist husband on Tuesdays, but that could count.
It could count, yeah.
It could. But it certainly might apply. Anyway, this is about getting something done together. And it's going to require some sort of sweat equity, like maybe mowing the grass or building a shed together. Or, no? We never built a shed.
No.
Okay. We built the wood shed thing.
Oh, yeah.
I was there.
Sure.
At least I was there. I watched. Anyway, but men especially bond over shoulder-to-shoulder closeness. So in other words, like doing something side-by-side with someone. So let's say he needs to fix the tractor, but you go out there as his wife and you help him track along with the YouTube tutorial and you hand him the wrench when he needs it. That's just another very vague example.
That was very vague. I don't know where you came up with that.
I don't know.
Okay, so next intimacy, crisis intimacy. This is standing together against the difficulties of life. And we're going to talk more about this in a little bit, but this is supporting each other when life really stinks. When someone we love dies, when we get a medical diagnosis that we didn't want to hear, when a friend is going through a rough time, when our kids are struggling, when we're struggling, and even though there's no one else around us maybe that we can lean on, we lean on each other, and we walk through that crisis together. And that shared experience is what brings us closer.
And then there's spiritual intimacy. And this is the sharing of ultimate concerns, which is a fancy way of saying what is the most important thing that we share in our lives, and that's our relationship with Jesus. We're going to talk about more of this in a bit, but this is where the togetherness of marriage should be rooted. And for singles, this is why it is so important not to marry somebody who isn't following Jesus.
And then finally, we do have physical intimacy. This is the sharing of our bodies. This is sexual. This is also non-sexual. Holding hands, a hand around the waist, a kiss when you get home from work. And physical intimacy is unique. And hear this. You can have some level of the other types of intimacy with people other than your spouse, right? You can have some intellectual intimacy with your coworkers. You can have some emotional intimacy with friends and family. You can have some spiritual intimacy with people in your prime group. But it is never, never ever okay to have some physical intimacy with anyone other than your spouse. This is what sets marriage apart from all other relationships that you have. It's the only time that it's okay to be friends with benefits. In most cases, men feel most connected to their wives through physical intimacy.
So that's all nine. If we look back at our story of Priscilla and Aquila, we can point out four levels of intimacy that they show. They probably had more. But these four are that as Christ followers, they had spiritual intimacy. They experienced work intimacy as they made their tents together. They had intellectual intimacy when they taught Apollos. And then they had crisis intimacy when they risked their lives for Paul and the gospel. But too often, the busyness of life gets in the way of our intimacy, and we start to feel disconnected from each other, and we stop feeling like a team. We begin to feel like there's this gap in our togetherness, and it can actually be really hard to get that back and get back on track.
So why is it so hard to get back on track? I mean, we're together. Why isn't it easier? Hear this. Because a husband prefers to rebuild connection, starting with physical intimacy. And the wife prefers to rebuild connections starting with emotional intimacy. And those are two very different starting points. And these differences are just the way that God created us. And if you have a problem with that, if that frustrates you, you can take it up with him. But in all seriousness, when we find ourselves in a spot of disconnectedness, what do we do? As part of the team, we have a responsibility to do whatever it takes to narrow that disconnectedness gap. And to do it, we need to be selfless. We need to put our spouse before ourselves. So instead of focusing on the intimacy that we want or that we prefer, we need to focus on the intimacy that we know our spouse needs. And we don't do this with the mindset of expecting something in return. We do it because that's the sacrificial love that we're called to in marriage. Connection and reconnection result when both of us make it a priority to meet the other's intimacy needs. Now, togetherness is handling conflict. Something else we find in our story about Priscilla and Aquila is that they faced and handled conflict together. Remember their story. They lost their home and everything they knew when they were kicked out of Rome. They moved multiple times, and if you moved, you know how stressful that is. And we assume that they later fled Rome under fear of persecution when Nero was in charge. Like any couple today, they faced challenges and crises and changes, and they had to learn how to work through those things together. But how much better to be working through them together than all alone?
So that's a large part of the Ecclesiastes passage. We see three separate statements where they talk about being together. The first one is, suppose either of them falls down, then the one can help the other up. Or second, or suppose two people lie down together, then they'll keep warm. And last, one person who could be overpowered, but two people can stand up for themselves. So remember, our togetherness is this team, right? And when conflict arises, we actually need to recognize and appreciate the fact that we each bring something different to the table. Think about Avengers before Marvel got weird.
They did get weird. Very weird.
But they had different strengths, and when they came together, they were unstoppable. But in conflict, we often lose sight of the fact that our spouse is actually our ally. And it is important to never look at our spouse as our enemy. You and your spouse, you do have an enemy, and that's Satan. Because Satan knows that a strong marriage of two Christ followers will have a great impact in the kingdom of God. Your marriage threatens him. And so he wants to weaken it and distract you by convincing you that your spouse is your enemy. But your spouse is not your enemy. So if you're sitting here today and your spouse is with you, on the count of three, I want you to turn to them and say, you are not my enemy. One, two, three. You are not. You say it.
You are not my enemy. Sorry.
Well, a little nervous there. Now,
most of us aren't going to be forced from our homes like Priscilla and Aquila. And we're probably not going to have to worry about being overpowered by people trying to harm us like the passage in Ecclesiastes. We might very well have some big stuff to face. Job loss, death, medical issues, addictions, infidelity. But more commonly, it's going to be about the day-to-day struggles, the day-to-day conflicts. See if any of these sound familiar. Finances. There's always tension about needing more money, about spending less money. Arguments about what to buy, what not to buy. Kids. Kids bring stress into a relationship from day one. all the crying and the pooping and the not sleeping and the cost of diapers and all that. Maybe you disagree on how to discipline or how to educate, or as they get older, you know, how much freedom you give them. How about in-laws? You know, when we get married, the families that we are leaving oftentimes have certain expectations of us that may not be the best for our new family, like where to spend holidays or how vacation looks. And they may want to give unrequested advice. Think Marie and Everybody Loves Raymond. And priorities. You know, maybe the husband's focus is his job and his career. Maybe the wife's focus begins to become the home and the kids. And for both, the marriage is no longer the top priority. The list of day-to-day conflicts can go on and on and on. And togetherness doesn't mean that you're always going to agree on things. That's just not possible. What it does mean is that you love your spouse so much and you value your marriage so much that you're willing to work through the disagreements. Well, to work through those conflicts. But how do you do that?
Well, to start off, we don't look at disagreements as debates, because a debate ends with a winner and a loser, and we're on the same team. So if one spouse loses, we both lose. You want to deliberate instead of debate. Talk about my side, your side. What's the best solution here? Sometimes the solution involves one person admitting that they're wrong.
This is the hard one. Yep.
But more often, it's both of the spouses coming to some sort of a compromise. But no matter what outcome you arrive at, it has to be both of you in agreement together. Amos 3:3 says, can two people walk together without agreeing on a direction? No, because you'll quickly find you're going nowhere. So we work through the conflict, we agree on a direction, then we put it behind us and we move forward.
Togetherness is handling conflict, but togetherness isn't automatic. This should come as no surprise to any of you who are married, except maybe the newlyweds. I won't look in that direction. Newlyweds, it's probably still unicorns and rainbows. Unicorns and rainbows. Last year, I taught that dating should be easy. I totally still believe that. Dating should be easy. It should be fun. But I also fully believe that marriage will be hard, because togetherness doesn't just spontaneously happen. Sorry, newlyweds. We're just being real here, okay? In fact, Paul, writing to the Corinthians in chapter 7, verse 28, said this, but if you do get married, it is not a sin. Good thing. And if a young woman gets married, it is not a sin. However, those who get married at this time will have troubles, and I'm trying to spare you those problems. You see, there was a lot of problems and difficulties for Christians at this time. We heard about some of that. And Paul knew that being married was going to add to that. It's going to add its own set of struggles and difficulties. Why is marriage hard? Isn't love enough? Yeah, love is enough, but love is hard. Because love isn't just that emotion that you get when your spouse walks into a room and your heart flutters a little bit. Love is a verb. That's Toby Mac back in the DC Talk days. It's something you do. It's a choice that you make every day. And your marriage is made up of day after day after day after day after day of making that choice. And it can get rather exhausting. It can get exhausting when your spouse isn't making it very easy to love them. It can get exhausting when it feels like your spouse isn't loving you back. It's been said, I really like this, it's been said that marriage isn't a contract based on ifs. It's a covenant based on even ifs. In other words, the love that you have for your spouse is not conditional. It's not, I'll love him if he changes this, or I'll love her if she does that. Rather, it's, I'll love him even if he doesn't change. I'll love her even if she doesn't do that.
And togetherness isn't automatic, because we're selfish. We want what we want when we want, and we don't want to sacrifice for it. But as Andy Stanley says, a Christian marriage isn't just two people who claim to be Christians getting married. It's a Christian marriage is two people who've submitted to the lordship of Jesus and therefore have submitted to each other. It's a submission competition. Dr. John Deloney suggests waking up each morning and asking your spouse, how can I love you today? And this takes the focus off of me and what I want and puts it on what do I want for him? What does he need today? Experts talk about the stages of marriage. There's a lot and they vary, but the first stage is generally like that beginning. And it's that honeymoon stage. And we have a ton of forgiveness for our spouse's shortcomings. And then eventually we move into reality, which legit is one of the stages. Like reality, then you have conflict. And then there might be some doubt. And you are probably having kids in this stage. And some people start asking, should I even have married this person? And some people consider divorce. But these later stages then, if you get through that and you get to those later stages, that's where the love deepens and the commitment is more cemented because through those tough stages, you chose each other. I know we had stages, we still have stages because we're still married, but when I think back to when I was homeschooling and he was working long hours, those were some of our least intimate years. And it's tough to look back on that, but it's so great to know we chose each other, and we're on the other side of that. I mean, right now we're in the, he goes to bed wearing a CPAP, and I wear this big honking mouth guard because I grind my teeth at night stage. It's adorable.
That's one word for it.
But every marriage has stress. And there's no perfect marriage because there are no perfect people. And if you see a successful marriage, it's not because they have it all together. They actually don't. It just, they worked for it. It didn't just happen easily. I mean, if you look at an athlete, right? So the athlete doesn't get to be great at his sport by just walking out onto the field. He has to practice. He has to eat right. He has to go to the gym for hours on end. The sacrifice the athlete makes it so that on game day, he gets out on that field. He looks like a natural. That guy's amazing. Yeah, but it's only because he honed those skills and he sacrificed for that and he worked hard. So togetherness doesn't just happen, but it can certainly become natural as a result of our intentional time and work.
If you don't put in the work to build that togetherness, you shouldn't be surprised if your marriage struggles. And it usually doesn't fall apart from one major catastrophic event. It's usually a slow drifting apart until one day you wake up and realize that there's this huge gap between you and your spouse, and you're wondering how it got there. Ernest Hemingway said this, "How do you go bankrupt? Two ways, gradually, then suddenly." No one plans to go bankrupt, just like nobody plans to have their marriage fail. But if you're not working hard at it, then drift is going to happen, and you risk bankrupting your marriage. It's impossible to eliminate all the difficulty in togetherness. It will always be there, whether you've been married for 8 weeks or over 80 years. Do you guys know there was a couple in Burnham a couple years ago that celebrated their 82nd anniversary? I mean, do you think we're going to make 82?
I'll be dead.
I'll be dead too, probably. If we did, that'd be awesome, though.
Yeah.
And we'll look back on this and be like, hey, we did it.
We'd be so old. They'd be changing our diapers. The boys would be like, just die.
We'll still be together.
Yeah.
Listen, you can't eliminate the difficulty, but it is possible to make it easier. And the one guarantee way to make it easier is by communication. You've got to talk to one another. So let's talk some practical communication tips. First off, you have to understand and respect how your spouse communicates. Because we each have different styles. Some need time to think about things carefully before speaking, while others can't think without speaking. Some need time to process. Others are really quick with what they want to say. Neither is wrong. Remember, God designed our differences to be complementary. Steph realized this, and we realized this really early on in our marriage, that we communicate very differently. I need time to process. She speaks more freely. So my silence during our discussions wasn't because I didn't care, although that's the way it came across. I just had to think through things before I responded. I'm a very logical thinker, if you will. But that simple understanding, once we understood that, it went such a long way in helping our togetherness.
So I'll tease that out for you. So what that looks like is if I want to talk to Justin about something that I know he's probably not going to agree with me on, I will say, hey, I've been thinking about this. Do you think you could pray about it and think about it? And he'll say, okay. And that's it. So, but I mean, I might kind of elaborate on my take on it, but I don't expect him to answer at the moment. And it won't be that day. It probably isn't even that week. It could be the next week or more if it's not time sensitive. And I'm the one usually who revisits this topic. And I say, hey, have you thought about and prayed about such and such? And he'll go, oh yeah, I have. And then we can sit down and have a conversation and a discussion about what he's thinking about it, what I'm thinking about it. It never turns into an argument. That time actually also gives me time to pray and think about, is that really how you feel about it? And God, where are you leading me in this for real? But I think time is awesome in any conversation, in any relationship. Just kind of back off, give it the time. And like I said, it never even turns into an argument just because he's had his space. He knows what he thinks. I know what I think. And we come to some sort of agreement.
Another tip about communication, don't talk down to each other or talk out to other people. Remember, this is your person, your best friend. Talk to them with the respect that they deserve. Talk to them as your partner, your equal, your teammate. Don't talk to them like they're beneath you or that you're somehow better than they are. And with that same respect, don't talk to other people about an issue in your marriage without talking to your spouse first. You don't go to your parents, your best friend, or your not your best friends, your friends at work, your kids. You go to each other first to discuss it. And a third tip, remember, in any discussion, you're not trying to win. Because of the intimacy that we share with our spouse, we know how to tear them down. We know their weaknesses. But we should never look to use those things to our advantage. We should never want to hurt our spouse. Other nevers, and I got these from a pastor by the name of Josh Howerton. He says this, never call names, never raise your voice, never get historical, don't drag things in from the past. Never say never or always, like you never do this, you always do that, and never threaten divorce. Togetherness is not automatic, but the more you work at it, the more natural it becomes. Togetherness is Christ-centered and kingdom-minded. Priscilla and Aquila were centered in Christ and committed to advancing his kingdom. It shows in all those passages that we read. We saw that they supported Paul during his missionary journey. We read that they hosted a church in their home in Ephesus and in Rome. And that was a big deal because, you know, Christians were being persecuted at that time. We saw that they discipled Apollos, teaching him more about Jesus. And it's not too much of a stretch to think that maybe when Paul wrote about marriage throughout the New Testament, that just perhaps he was influenced by the marriage that he saw in Priscilla and Aquila, because he spent a lot of time with them, and they had a godly marriage. Ecclesiastes 4:12 says this, "And a rope made of three cords isn't easily broken." And if we view this in the context of marriage, God is the third cord in our rope. He's the one that you and your spouse are woven around. And as each of you get closer to God, you end up getting closer to each other. The rope tightens. So marriage isn't just about tying the knot. It's about weaving a rope.
Your marriage has a higher purpose than just staying together and liking each other. First, as two Christ followers who are married, we are to pray for each other and encourage each other to grow to become more like Christ. Proverbs 27:17 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so a friend sharpens a friend." You are your spouse's sharpener. Get on it. Number two, the relationship we have with our spouse is supposed to represent the relationship that Christ has with the church. Christ died for us when we didn't deserve it. Pastor Tim Keller has said, Jesus didn't die for us because we were lovely. He died for us to make us lovely. The way that we sacrifice for our spouse should encourage other Christ followers, challenge non-Christ followers, and set an example for our children someday to have a solid marriage built on Christ. And finally, God intended your marriage to be a reflection of who he is. He planned it that way when he made male and female in his image. So together, you represent the image of God. And as two committed Christ followers who are actively bearing God's image, your marriage can have a staggering effect on the world. Remember, Priscilla and Aquila simply opened their home, supported a friend, this is awesome. And willingly spoke into someone's life. And in doing so, they helped Paul and Apollos spread the gospel to the world. And they're still impacting us today. Sorry, I don't know why I'm crying.
So what does a day-to-day kingdom-minded focus look like in our marriages? Here's just a few ideas. Commit to growing closer to God individually and as a couple. This goes beyond church and church-related activities, although that's important. You should pray together. You should consider doing a YouVersion plan together. Maybe watch some teachings online. There's so many things out there. And then discuss them afterwards. Serve together somewhere. That could be here at MC3, but maybe it's in Oaxaca. Maybe it's at the shelter. Talk to Chris Hale. It could even be your neighbor down the street. Kingdom-minded means always talking to each other with respect and love and being willing to ask forgiveness and to grant forgiveness. It also includes being willing to have hard conversations with your spouse if you see something that they're doing that's not God-honoring. And hearing those hard conversations from your spouse without getting defensive.
Kingdom-minded is being responsible with the resources that God has given us. It means not going into debt in order to keep up with the Joneses and praying about large financial decisions. It means giving generously and sacrificially to the church and to those in need. Kingdom-minded is weighing every decision, your job, your entertainment choices, your kids' activities, in light of how does this affect our witness for Christ? One personal example for us, we've got kids who play a lot of sports. It takes a lot of time, and it can look like, well, you don't care about anything else, you care about sports. But at home, at our dinner table, you know what you hear? You hear us telling our kids, be a light for Christ on that ball field. You shine Jesus to those kids because you might be the only Jesus they ever see and the only chance that they can hear about Jesus. Our kids understand there's a much higher purpose to them just being a baseball player. They have a higher purpose than just being a football player.
One more kingdom-minded idea. As a couple, you should not only disciple your kids to help them grow in the faith, but you should also look to come alongside other young believers. And then on the flip side, you should look to share with people who don't know Jesus. Okay, as a couple, share with other people. That means being intentional about spending time with couples who aren't Christ followers. But what it also means is when you spend time with them, that you don't participate in things with them that aren't honoring to God. So, for example, you're not going with them and getting drunk. You're not gossiping with them. You're not sitting around telling inappropriate jokes just because you're trying to fit in, just because you want them to see you as a normal couple. I got news for you, folks. You are not supposed to be a normal couple. Your marriage is supposed to be so not normal that others are drawn to it, and they want to know what makes your marriage different. Pursuing a kingdom-minded focus as a couple gives you and your spouse something to work towards, and it promotes intimacy. So togetherness is Christ-centered and kingdom-minded, and togetherness isn't too late. Because if your marriage is centered around God, He can certainly work in you and work in your spouse to change your marriage. And we know that our God is a God of change. He changed Saul from a murderer to a missionary. He changed Chris from a punk to a pastor. A better togetherness, a better marriage is not too late. You see, we should always be looking to increase the level of togetherness that we have with our spouse. And as we said earlier, there's no perfect marriage because there's no perfect people. Every marriage has its own stuff. So don't get stuck constantly comparing your marriage to someone else's. Seeing all the areas of togetherness that you wish you had. And that's not to say that you can't look at other marriages and be challenged to make changes in your own. But just be careful. Be careful because comparison quickly destroys contentment. And that applies to all areas of our life. So what are some practical steps to achieve better togetherness today? Allergies. First, you have to have the desire to change. Whatever your marriage is like today, it can be better tomorrow. We should never think that we've somehow arrived or somehow achieved the best marriage. There's always going to be room for improvement. And we should want that. We should desire that. Even if you have a good marriage, don't settle for good. Go for great. Remember, your togetherness should reflect God's design for marriage. And his design for marriage was perfect.
So take some time together this week to go over the various aspects of intimacy that we talked about and ask yourselves, what are we good at? And celebrate it. Celebrate it. That's a win. Tony Robbins has said you're always happy when you're appreciating and utilizing whatever life gives you. So if you're good at it, great. Like, yay, we do this really well. And then take a minute and go, okay, where do we need to improve? And be gracious here, because one of you might disagree and be like, I thought we were good at that. No, we're definitely not. I mean, let it be a conversation, not an argument, but just handle it with grace. And then once you decide, okay, these are the areas we need to work on, commit them to God. Proverbs 16:3 says, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and he will establish your plans. So ask God to give you the wisdom and the strength to make the changes that need to be made. And then finally, work together for change. This requires action. So do you want to improve emotional intimacy? Carve out some time each day without distractions to talk to each other. Pastor Tim Keller has said we need at least 90 minutes a week of talking with our spouse. That breaks down to 12.8 minutes per day.
Only 12.8 minutes?
You can do it.
We can do it, yep.
Do you want more physical intimacy? You can buy Twister. No? Okay. Wait, plan your physical intimacy.
Nothing is going to change in your togetherness if nothing changes in your togetherness. We invest our time and our resources in things that are important to us. Your marriage needs to be your most important investment next to your relationship with God. Spend the time, do the work, make the change. And lastly, listen, if you need help, don't be afraid to ask for it. It doesn't somehow make you weak or make you a bad Christ follower if you can't figure out how to improve your togetherness without help, or if there are things standing in the way that you just can't sort out on your own. Maybe it's just meeting with another couple who has been married for a longer time and letting them tell you their story and share some of their wisdom with you. Maybe it's attending a marriage seminar or a couples retreat or just going through a marriage devotional together. Maybe it's seeking out a counselor, and whether that's here in the church with Kendra or somebody outside the church who she can recommend. Just don't be ashamed to ask for that extra voice to speak into your marriage. Your marriage is too important to not do everything you can to help it thrive. As we end this morning, I want to share with you something I recently heard from Nick Saban. Nick Saban was the football coach down at the University of Alabama. I don't root for Alabama, but I thought what he said was wise here. He was talking about how we have five choices in life regarding the things that we do. We can be bad at what we do. We can be average at what we do. We can be good at what we do. We can be excellent, or we can be elite. And everyone has a choice as to how we do what we do. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort to be bad or even average at what we do. And if we have the right gifts, we can do good without much effort. But he said that if you want to be excellent or you want to be elite at something, you have to really want it. You have to work hard at it with a special intensity and a special focus and a special commitment. And even though he was mostly talking about this from the viewpoint of athletics, the same is true for our marriages. If we want a marriage that we enjoy, one that our spouses and those around us want to copy, one that impacts non-believers and points them to Jesus, then we can't settle for average or good. We need to aim to be elite in our togetherness, recognizing that it's going to take sacrifice. It's going to take commitment. It's going to be hard. It's going to take intensity. But folks, I can tell you, it's going to be so, so worth it. It is so worth it to put in that work. Let's pray. God, we thank you so much for the example that we see in Priscilla and Aquila. We thank you that we can look to them to see what true togetherness is meant to be. Just help us as a couple to draw closer to you so that we can draw closer to each other. And we just pray that you'd point out those areas in our marriages where we need to improve our intimacy. Help us to do that. Help us to realize that our marriage is meant for more, that through our marriage, we can help advance your kingdom and we can help draw people into a relationship with you. It's in your name. Amen.